Welcome to the new podcast episode of Literatunat. This again is an English episode. I'm doing this all by myself without Jamie because I am talking about two novels today from Sarah Langan. Sarah Langan is my guest. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Yvonne. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
Is this your first podcast in Germany?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And I will talk about two novels, Good Neighbors and A Better World, which are your two most recent novels, like from this year and...
I think Good Neighbors came out in 2021, and they're pretty recent.
I have read the Locus interview in the August magazine, where we were talking about these two novels, and I was interested, and I thought this might be something for me. Sounds like stories about mothers, and then something strange happens, and then everything gets really spooky, and so I bought both novels and read both, and now we read them both, and asked you if you want to join me for an interview. So as I'm fairly sure my usual listener will not know you, might you introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Sarah Langan, and I've been writing for a very long time, but I'm slow. So I've published 5 novels, and I kind of write stories that get categorized as speculative fiction or fantasy, science fiction, horror, but sometimes realism too. And I think what I'm doing is I'm just trying to tell the most honest emotional story I can in my work and things I'm thinking about while using fantastical elements, if that helps anyone in any way, or maybe that confuses them. I don't know.
In this podcast, we have mostly science fiction, but also horror, and sometimes it's not clear. So the not clear genre is also welcome. And I was thinking about it. So genre is not that important for me. The story has to be good. That's it. And I think in the Locus interview, you said, I want you, at the end of the novel, I want you to either cry or want to throw up.
Yeah.
And if nothing like this happened, I failed. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting goal. And maybe with Good Neighbors at the end, I cried. And with A Better World, I wanted to throw up.
That makes me so happy.
I just finished my second run on A Better World this morning, like 10 hours ago or so. And the end is really, really, really icky. Yes. Let's talk first about Good Neighbors, which I read first, by the way, and in the second one also again first. And my first impression was there are many perspectives. With A Better World, we have Linda's perspective. It's more or less one perspective, but with Good Neighbors, we have many more perspectives. At first, I couldn't decide because, okay, we have to tell our listeners what this novel is about. Maybe you start and then I will add something.
Sure. So it's about a cul-de-sac of a suburban town, and it's in the near future. And by near, I published it in 2021, but I think it's 2027 is when it's set. And everyone is economically a little bit worse and global warming's a little bit worse. And what happens is this tight-knit community has newcomers move in called the Wilds. It's this family who've been saving as much money as they can for 10 years for a down payment on a house to move up in the world and become middle class. And they've been working for it. And the rest of the people on the cul-de-sac are uncomfortable and uneasy with them because it represents their own decline, because everyone's struggling. And so there's this tension when they first get there that becomes worse with time as a sinkhole appears in the middle of the cul-de-sac. And one of the prominent family's children goes missing down the cul-de-sac. And then it becomes a question of blame. Whose fault is it that this child is missing? And it's a lot of questions about, like, what does the future look like? And what are people's fears? And quickly, the new family gets scapegoated. And it's about that, but it's also about the specific personalities involved that make this cul-de-sac a tinderbox.
And first, my sympathies were with Gertie Wild, who's the mother of the new family, and she has two kids. Julia is already 12, but Larry is only 8, and he's a weird kid. He seems to be extremely intelligent, but as some kids develop unevenly, some things don't really work well yet. And people from the outside call him an Aspie, as they think he might be not, well, he might be neurodivergent. I don't know the word in English, how to pronounce it.
Yeah, that's right. Neurodivergent.
Yeah, neurodivergent. So, and I know something about kids who develop unevenly. I am a mother myself too, and this really helps me because there I have it, black on white. Some kids just do some things quicker than others, and other stuff doesn't come so naturally, and later he will maybe turn out fine. I was very much on Gertie's side, and Gertie has this thing with Rhea, her neighbor, or it's Rhea.
Rhea? Yeah.
Her German husband maybe pronounced it differently. So I didn't have the audiobook with this book. I had the audiobook with A Better World, so this helps sometimes. I was absolutely on Gertie's side, and Rhea is the bad one, and she ghosts her, and she doesn't invite her anymore to any things, and something has happened, and they are not friends anymore, and Gertie doesn't understand it. And then the perspective changes, and I learn about Rhea's side. And then I felt sympathy with Rhea, who has to raise 4 kids on her own, and her husband is always away, like always, not like the usual father who works a little bit longer, but really always away. He's not in the picture at all.
Well, I mean, he's, even if he's in the room, he's not there. He's emotionally gone.
She's lonely.
Yeah, she's completely lonely. She has no tools, and she was not raised in a way that would help her cope with it. She just has no idea what she's doing.
Yes. The one kid has already moved away, like Gretchen is in college already. Then she has FJ, who's 19 years old, but still needs her, and Shelly, who's 13, and Ella, who's 9. And she's working again. She's a college professor herself. And she has so much on her plate. And there's this key scene. For me, it's a key scene, you know. It is in the recent past, and she has this talk with Gertie and says, "Sometimes I imagine I'm a giant. I squeeze my whole family into pulp. I wish them dead so I can be free. I can't leave them. I'm their mother. I'm not allowed to leave them. So I hate them. Isn't that awful? God, aren't I a monster?" And for me, this is like the big cry for help. Please, Gertie, understand me, the situation I am in. I'm trying to reach out to you. Please do something. Listen to me. And this goes completely wrong. And Gertie doesn't understand and reacts in a way that's not helpful for Rhea. And that's it. The friendship seems to be destroyed afterwards for both sides.
Yeah, what I love is Gertie doesn't really understand that's why the friendship is over either. She's like, "That was weird when you said that. I thought it would be polite to ignore it." and Rhea's like, "I'm losing my mind and I need help. And you like treated me like I was a monster." And in Gertie's perspective, she wasn't thinking she was a monster at all. She really liked her. She just thought, Well, that was a slip of the tongue. You know, that's probably not what she intended to say to me, so I'm going to ignore it.
Wasn't there a later in the novel, like much later, like too late, that Gertie has the impression, maybe that was the moment and maybe that's something went over my head there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so tragic because if Gertie has reacted in some way, because I'm a mother, I have said something like that, not in that, you know, not that harsh, but like, I love my kids, but sometimes I just want to go to New Zealand and never come back. And I was more lucky than we are because the mother I talked to understood what I meant. Because, of course, sometimes it's just too much work to be a mother. And for Rhea, it's extreme. She has four kids. And this cul-de-sac where she lives, people have strange expectations. And they are all these baking these cakes and being soccer moms. And I don't know. I'm not under this kind of pressure. I don't live in such a, you know, suburban middle-class situation. So it's better, but I think Rhea is really sick and it's getting worse.
I had a moment, so this is like an aside, but both of my daughters had their periods and it was like 9 at night when they told me that like they were out of tampons, or not tampons, pads. And I was like, I was about to be like, can we just find something and I'll get you something in the morning? Like, we have gauze. Because it's like a long trip into town. And then I was like, oh, but I wrote my character did that to her daughter. So I can't do it because my character's not nice. So I was like, no, I'll be back after you're in bed. And then I'll just stick them outside your door. I'm going to go now get them. But no, the pressures of parenting are excruciating, especially for mothers, I think. And I think when mothers express their unhappiness, they're often shut down. And it's because it's a few things. But I think people don't want to think that their own mothers were unhappy. It's like so upsetting to them that they can't relate to it. And then I think the only people who understand are other mothers that you can talk to about stuff like that. And I've had times, I think every woman who's a mother has had that time where you make the call. Like, I don't know if you, but like pretty much everyone I've ever talked to, you wake up and you're like, I can't do it. I'm broke. And you call somebody and you're like, I'm out. And they come. It's like, it's the universal call. I had it. I've had friends who had it where you just go, not today, not today. And like, my mom just showed up in my house. And I was like, she immediately, like, and she had to take the train in. I lived in Brooklyn. She had to take it from Long Island. And I was like, I was in really dire straits, mom. Something, you know, I was really upset. And she was like, yeah, you made the call. Like, that's the call. Everyone knows what the call is. We just don't talk about it because it's shameful in some way, because it implies we don't love our children. But of course we do. It's just a lot of pressure and a lot of loneliness.
When I had that call, my friend completely understood, and it was clear to me that she understood, but she lives 12 hours away, so she couldn't come. But I was relieved that she completely understood me, because I sort of felt like a monster in that moment too.
It's terrifying. It's really scary. And it passes. But another interesting aspect of it is in my writing, the first thing Hollywood wants to do when they adapt my stuff is to make the mom more likable. No one ever wants to keep my stuff as it is because they think they can't sell it. But I think the problem with that is they're making all of these movies and TV shows that they find, oh, this is interesting. These mom stories are hot right now. Let's sanitize them so that everyone likes them. And they just are taking the teeth out of this pretty important issue.
Yeah, I was thinking about They have done the Leanne Moriarty Netflix stuff, and I think there were some differences between books and series, and they have done Big Little Fires Everywhere, but I think that was better. I think the mother had some edges.
Yeah. I didn't watch those. I think I watched, there was that first one with Reese Witherspoon.
Big Little Lies?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it was fine, but like it's in the end, everyone, you know, once you get to know them, they're really good on the inside. is except for bad guys. And I think it's more interesting, these stories about complicated women.
So will there be a series of Good Neighbors?
Still in the works. You know, I've been pitching it for a while now. I hope so. It would be great.
Yeah, I thought about it too. So recently I learned in a story, there has to be one protagonist. Only one. And it can't be missing, and there can't be two. And now I am thinking, so who's the protagonist of Good Neighbors? And I was divided between Rhea, who's the villain, more or less, and Julia. And because for me, it can't be Gertie, can't it? Can it? Can it be Gertie?
I'm happy with an ensemble cast of not necessarily having a single hero. I like Gertie. I wouldn't say she is. I would say Julian and Rhea are the strongest characters in the book. What was funny to me is Gertie does this thing early on, which is also just like, what happens? I wasn't great at conflict resolution, like pretty bad at it when my kids were young. And I didn't know how to handle things, and I had to learn. And Gertie, early on in the story, sees that the kids are teasing her kids when she's dropping them off. And instead of like figuring out how to deal with that, she drives away because she's like, I'll probably make it worse. I don't know what to do. And she feels bad about it the whole time. And there were so many people who were like, I hated her after that. I knew she was a bad mom. And it's like, bad moms are, you know, that's some criteria for what a bad mom is. Someone who's like scared and leaves one time. So it's funny. But anyway, yeah, I love Julia. Julia's terrific. She's, the kids in the story are sort of the hope of the story. It's this idea that even though the parents are not able to confront the truth directly, which is what much of the story is about, that. Why is Shelley Schroeder gone? What happened to her? And what's happening to the world that these kids are inhabiting, that a sinkhole is suddenly formed? Because the unspoken thing, the elephant in the room, is global warming's really bad, and it's threatening to eat all the children. It'll pull every one of them down that sinkhole. And the kids can acknowledge that, and the parents can't, because it's so upsetting to them, and they feel so guilty about it. So the kids, I think, they do the brave things that the adults have such a hard time doing. And Julie is the real ringleader of that.
I also thought that Shelley, the daughter of one of the daughters of Rhea, the one who gets her period, her menstruation, I think both words work in English. Okay. That was a really complex character as well, because she was so mean to Julia, who used to be her friend. And when they end up to talk alone, when nobody else is listening, and it becomes clear that Shelley still feels like Julia is her friend. And it's just complicated for her, really complex. And she's disappointed because she wanted Julia to rescue her and let her move in with her and all these things. And of course, that's too much to ask, I think, of a 12-year-old girl. I really liked that because I was already ready to hate Shelley because she was so mean to Julia. And then they had, the two of them had this moment, and I understood, no, it's not that easy. It's, you were too fast to be against her. Maybe she is nice. She's just, yeah, well, has a hard time.
I think friendships at that age are so defining of who we become, those middle school friendships. And there's so much on the line at that age because you realize that your parents are flawed. And this person in your life is different and has opened this different view of what life could be to you. And you talk about God and you talk about what you want to be and what you hope and who you think you are and who you want to become. And there's so much happening. And I think that Julia, even though things haven't been easy for her, she can't conceive of how hard they've been for Shelley. And Shelley knows that, and it's infuriating and lonely, and she takes it out on Julia in the way that kids do. Those friendships that are so significant, she has no one else to take it out on. There's no one for her. Her only person is Julia. And so that's happening. But I also think there's this tendency to underestimate kids. Adults look back and think they can't handle this. They can't talk about that. They're not experiencing these kinds of feelings. We have to shelter them. And in fact, it's very clear to this group of kids, the Rat Pack, that Shelley's going through something serious and something bad is happening to her. And they all know it, even Julia. And when they're at the trampoline and Shelley is acting crazy, they know it. And they're disgusted by it, but they're also completely empathetic. And later you get the boys talking to Julia saying, it's not right what her house is. There's something really wrong. Then Julia thinking like, I can't hate her. I want to hate her, but I see her pain. It's huge. And I think it's all acting out. It's just Shelley hoping someone will see and save her. And Julia wants to. Like, everybody would like to save her. That's the problem with when you see that. And as an adult, you see it sometimes, too. It's a really terrible thing when you see a kid whose parents, for whatever reason, even though they love that kid, are doing something that's damaging. And it's very difficult to intervene. Almost impossible, I think. And I think that's just, it's a universal, just everyone knows what that is and everyone has compassion for it.
Yes. I am also under the impression that the teenagers in this story and also in A Better World, I'm thinking about Josie in A Better World, are really strong characters who see the truth much earlier than their parents or other adults. As you have mentioned Stephen King's Carrie as an inspiration in another podcast, I now dare to compare your books to Stephen King novels because in his novels, often the teenagers see more than the adults as well. They are the heroes of the books because they are fighting against the monsters and they are rescuing not the world, but, you know, the neighborhood or the city or Derry or something like this. And in this book, the Rat Pack, which is the nickname for all the neighborhood kids, save a body in the end, which is really important and really dangerous. I was very afraid. It's really nice. And also in A Better World, teenagers play an important role, at least one or two. It's less there because there's no Rat Pack there, unfortunately, but well.
Well, I think that adults are invested in the everyday, you got to go to work and you got to earn some money and you got to keep the house tidy and you got to get the clothes and the drive to the sports and keep all these plates spinning.
Mm.
And kids get to look at it and think, does this make sense? What are you doing? They have the time and they aren't as invested. They can say, you know, it's especially that adolescent time where they can judge. Where's this going? What's the point of it?
It's nice that you have a defense answer for that. I'm not feeling so bad anymore. Yeah, of course. Our hands and our heads are really full. That's true. But it's nice. Always when I read a novel like this, I can feel like a teenager again. And I can remember how it was like. And it wasn't so nice while I was a teenager, but in retrospective, it feels better.
Have you ever seen The Breakfast Club?
No.
Okay. It's this John Hughes popular 1980s movie with like these teenagers. And Ally Sheedy's character says, it's inevitable when you're old, you don't have a heart anymore. You lose your heart. That's what happens when you become an adult. And I remember seeing that as a kid and just weepy because I was like, it's true. That's what happens. And I swear, I hope that never happens to me. I never want to become like that. And I am like that now. And it's not so bad. But I've become an adult and I'm like, these things you're upset about, I can't let them in. It's too much for me. I can't worry about a war and the weather and whatever. I just am going to make sure the car works. And it's just this thing that happens. But I do love remembering that kid that I was.
Mm. Yeah. And that works. And I have another quote for you from you. It's lonely being a grown up.
Yeah, it is. Well, I feel like you're making it up and you can't let your kids know you're making it up. that's like the part of being a grown-up is keeping that shit in. You can, instead of worrying them about it. Yeah.
Yeah. This was my sheet for Good Neighbors.
Wow.
I have another sheet for a better world. But when we want to come back for some idea to Good Neighbors, no problem. Would you give us, please, a short summary of what A Better World is all about?
A Better World is a little further into the future. And again, it's a world that's been affected by climate change, in which global governments have lost authority and given rise to the multinational corporation. And these corporations are pretty unregulated. So my main character is a doctor, pediatrician. Doctors don't make any money anymore. And her husband works for the FDA, which is an American, the Food and Drug Administration in America that regulates. And he's fired because the FDA has just been disbanded pretty much. No more regulation. The family lives in Brooklyn, where it's not very safe, and they're very worried that they won't be able to afford their rent. And just at this time, the husband receives a job offer from one of these big corporations that has a company town that's walled off and is self-contained. If you get in there, you're set for life. The only question is, will they accept you? You have to get tenure. You have to be there 20 years. They've got all kinds of rules. You lose your ability to vote in elections. And the family knows it's a fool's bargain going into it. They know it's a bad idea, but they also know they don't have any chances or other options. So they move there. And the story quickly gets very Shirley Jackson, The Lottery, where something's going on in this town. And Linda, the main character, is trying to make get along with all of the other successful people in the town. But the more she learns, the more enemies she starts making. And it starts to be about, should they stay? Who will leave if they leave? The mother wants to leave, but her husband and son don't. Her daughter is a wreck. And how are they handling this completely new society? What's going to happen? Because ultimately, it starts to feel as if something very violent and insidious exists in this town.
And maybe we should mention that it's really difficult for them to leave because they have used the college fund money to get in, and it's not clear if they can get it back out, and they don't even have a car that they own. They own nothing. They don't have any money because this Plymouth Valley company town works without any money. And Dr. Fielding, who is, by the way, my favorite side character, who used to be Linda's boss, dies someday in the novel and is not there. And it's difficult to go back, and everything is difficult, and they are more or less on foot and have no place to go to. So it's really difficult to leave. So even as it becomes clear for me that they really should leave, I can see that it's not so easy. But yes, this has more world building, like unemployment is with 25%, and there's a drug I've never heard about, GLAMP, which is very important for Linda because her parents were addicted to GLAMP and died because of it in Poughkeepsie. And I hear in the radio there's the fall of Berlin. I don't even know what that means. Is Berlin now not existent anymore? And all the information all of a sudden is closed access. I work in a library, so for us, open science and open source and open access is so important. And all of a sudden, you don't get any information if you want to research medicaments or certain sickness. You can't. You don't. There's no information. And there's lots of drinking.
Yeah. The information siloing is a big part, I think, of it's a big fear for me because I feel like it's where culturally we're headed. You know, I have a background in science. There's also been this co-opting of science by corporations in ways that support their products and undermine the actual scientific method. So, I mean, how did we wind up with OxyContin? I don't know, you know, I'm sure you guys know, have followed that a little bit. I know Germans only prescribe pain medicine for acute pain, but, you know, we've got a huge drug crisis in America because of our corporations. And it was very clear all along it was an addictive drug, and anyone paying attention knew that. But somehow that didn't matter because the scientists were shut up and stifled. And that seems to happen again and again.
Yeah. Some weird stuff has happened here too, but maybe we shouldn't go dive too deep into that. So here it's a clear hero or a clear protagonist. That's Linda, and it's only her perspective. And a little bit on the side, like news articles and parts of essays and stuff, which Good Neighbors also contained. And I think the premise is much more clear here, because my takeaway from the novel is you shouldn't shut yourself from the world to save your family. That's not the way to go. You can read it as a metaphor for climate change. We can't hide, and we shouldn't hide. It's there for everybody. And, well, and they try to hide in Plymouth Valley, because the air is better. And when I was reading it for the second time, I wasn't so surprised anymore, because when I read it the first time, I was very surprised in the end to learn that Linda was ill and was coughing all the time. But it was all there. when I read it the second time, she was coughing all the time. I didn't realize it either when I first read the book. And then I saw, yes, she was affected by the bad air as well. It was not only for other reasons. She was really sick. She was not well. And then she's in Plymouth Valley and her sickness stops because the air is better. But the price is really, really, really high.
It's a tough one. I mean, throwing that in, if Linda didn't have that sickness, it's really easy to make the argument that they shouldn't have gone and it would be easy to leave. But once you have throw health problems into the mix, it gets a lot tougher. But yeah, I mean, the book is very much about closing your world off and making fear decisions doesn't help anyone. It makes everything worse. And I think that's true. And I did some research on preppers and people who are, you know, there are people who spend millions of dollars on nuclear shelters and they're coffins. They're just coffins. There are places where they're going to live with maybe one other person that they've planned this. And first off, I'm not sure the science backs the idea that they would survive if there was a bad enough nuclear bomb. So it's a lot of money to spend that they could have spent on, say, you know, improving their local school. But on top of that, it's this idea, this bizarre idea of American exceptionalism, and that I really think is created more problems than it's solved.
Yes. And in the novel, first, everybody is so polite to them and just friendly and always smiling, but not going really deep. And this will be maybe the first time you hear that. But when you're from Germany and you go to the USA, especially like states like Utah, not New York or so, but in Utah, everybody is like this, really friendly. How are you doing? Where are you from? Oh, how interesting. Come always. My door is always open. But that's only the surface. What's deeper, you never learn if you're not there for a couple of years, I guess. And so for me, they all behave like normal Americans. But obviously, they didn't feel like this because they expected to make friends, at least the teenagers, but also the parents. As a North Germany person, so I think it's pretty normal not to make friends because you need more than a couple of weeks or so. So that's normal, but they just felt really strange. Then she gets to know her boss, Mitch Chernin. I pronounce him wrong, do I? Chernin?
Oh, Chernin, yeah.
Yeah, the old guy who's married to the guy in the wheelchair. And he's different because he's really direct to her, and that's so refreshing. And then she meets these three women, Rachel Johnson, who works a lot out, and she's an outsider too, so she wasn't born in Plymouth Valley, and Danielle Bennett, who's also an outsider, who's from Vegas and has some tough things in her past, and Anouk Parson, who's absolutely inbred, second or third generation. It's even hinted at that her son is, well,
yeah.
There was some subtle incest thing going on. Yeah, okay, I understood that right. So she's completely over the top. So Linda gets to know these three women and gets a job offer, which is really important for her because now she has only one shift a week in the hospital, and that's not enough. And then she gets the job offer and gets to know these three women. Literally, a few hours later, she gets to know Gail Parker, who they want to throw out because her wife, Trish, has left Plymouth Valley, and Gail is only the wife. And
yeah, if you don't work and your spouse leaves you, you can't stay. You're out.
Which is logical, but seems very harsh. And she has two sick kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not very human. Then everything goes very action, very fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Gal does something really, really, Gal's crazy. Gal is like just out of her mind. Like she hits on everybody in a room. She says the worst things, but she's a truth speaker. In the middle of a place where no one speaks the truth.
So if you wanted to write a horror novel, you have succeeded, because yesterday when I was taking my little child to bed, I have two children, 9 and 5 years old, and I was taking the 5-year-old to bed, and he was lying next to me trying to get to sleep, and I thought, okay, if there would be a fire, and I have to rescue my two children, and I have no help, would I really choose one? And then try to leave the house and then go in again. And I decided, no, I would try to save both, no matter how, because I was would be really afraid when by the time I go back, it would be too late for the second one, or for some reason I cannot enter the house, or all these kind of things can happen. It's such a spooky situation. I can't get it out of my head.
Yeah. About a year ago, I was in Oregon on the coast, and my kids and I were like looking in the rocks and the jetties, and a rogue wave came and knocked us all down. There were all these rocks. And as soon as I got up, I saw my older daughter. I made sure she was okay. And then I was like, where's Francis? It's my little one. And the water had carried her. But a man had grabbed her hand to keep her from being washed out and was holding her. And it was the scariest thing of my life. It was just insane. And I remember looking at them both as the wave was coming, and I stood where I was thinking I would block the wave, right? Like I was going to block the wave with my body. And I was like, go in, run. And they were looking at me like, what? And then I thought, I'm a very good swimmer and I'm very strong. I thought there's no way it'll knock me down. I'll just stand like a barricade. It knocked me down right away. Just knocked me right down. And I got up and terrifying. And I remember thinking, how do you survive when you're all there and one is hurt? I don't know. An aside, but I'm so grateful everybody was okay. We were all exhausted and went home and took immediate naps. Like it was so emotional for all of us.
Yeah, but that's what I look for when I read. I don't have to read if it's only about things I already know. I really look for these kind of things. I have to tell you, A Better World was life-changing for me the first time I read it, because there's this moment when it's towards the end, the marriage is not really bad. It's just, well, Russell has a difficult time with other human beings. He has a difficult time with his children. He's very absent. He doesn't really know what to do. He has worked a lot. He wasn't really there. He's not like Fritz Schröder, not that bad, but he has difficulties to cope. Towards the end, so Linda and Russell have two kids. They're both 15-year-old twins, Josie and Hip, and we will never learn what Hip stands for.
I thought it was Hippocrates, like the Hippocrates Oath, if I'm saying, or Hippocratic. Yeah.
She's a doctor.
Yeah.
So towards the end, Hip tells her sister about Linda. That's because she thinks men can't do anything. She goes easy on them. That's why Dad gets away with so much. She thinks he's a house with holes in its roof. I felt caught, because whenever a father tells me how hard his life is, taking care about children, I think, without knowing anything about him, I think, you're just the father. You can't tell me. Let me talk to your wife. I'm really sorry. I really know for a fact that there are fathers out there and their life is different, and their life might be even more difficult than my life because they are alone with their children and everything. I know that for a fact. But statistically, it's very likely that it's no use to talk to him. Just hand over to your wife, because What can you tell me? You're just the father. And that's what patriarchy does, not only to women, but to men as well. That some women like me, as I now know, and it really hurts me to my stomach, don't take them seriously in some topics, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, I remember preschool in back in Brooklyn, there was a dad. You know, he was the stay-at-home dad. One of my friends was like, yeah, I'm not having him over my house. And I was like, why? And she's like, a guy? And I was like, this isn't making it better for any of us. If we can't let men be primary caregivers, if we can't let them in, we're just forcing women into the role.
Yeah.
It happened to me once. I was caught because, I don't know if you have this, but you think like, oh my God, could my husband just please be on the freaking CCs and the texts? And it's always the mom. And you just get used to it. And a dad wrote to me and said, you know, I really arrange most of these things. So if from now on, you would please just keep me in the loop. And I, first off, I really appreciated he'd said that because it's hard to say. And I like knowing where I stand. But second off, I thought, yeah, guilty. I was guilty. I didn't want to deal with you. I just wanted to deal with the lady. Yeah, I think every time that a woman says, I don't want the husband taking care of these kids, I'd be more comfortable if it was the mom. It's making the mom's life harder.
Yeah, I think you caught me there. But yes, usually it's almost always the moms. I don't think that's good. Hopefully that will change. We should not forget this really spooky animals, the caladrios, which can only live in Plymouth Valley because it really needs fresh air and it's eating everything. And with everything, I mean even he would eat himself and he would eat human beings and he eats everything and he's really icky.
Yeah, it's this genetically engineered bird that the town made thinking it would be more energy efficient than chicken. And it is, and you don't have to feed it as much. However, it's a hothouse flower and it can only live in places with very clean air, which is essentially just Plymouth Valley. And so the caladrius is a mythological creature. That's what I named it after. That in ancient Rome was reputed to eat the sins of kings. And it's kind of cool because they would, you know, if a king was sick, they would bring this bird in. And if the bird turned away, it meant the king wasn't going to have its sickness eaten. But if it did, then it was like a phoenix. It was supposed to rise up and be cleaned by the sun. And then I think it's also, you know, I was raised Catholic, and I think there's a lot of religious elements in this cult. So there's some referencing to the Holy Spirit, which is also this. Yeah.
And we should also mention that toward the end of this novel, there is lots of good written splatter.
Yeah.
I just listened to it again this morning. There's this moment, and I have read lots of horror novels, lots of different authors, but there's this moment, I think that was a new one for me, where I think one eye went out, and he could still see, but it doesn't make sense anymore, because this eye is not where it used to be and where it should be, because, well, I had this, you know, this picture in my head, and he tries to see.
Yeah, that was fun.
I think there should be an award for the most ickiest but really well-written scene for this scene.
Well, the thing is, I thought, you know, when you're a woman, like, there's only a few places if you're not as strong as the guy that you can go for. So she goes for the eyes. But the truth is, you can't pop an eyeball. It's pretty much impossible. You can pull it out. So I thought, I'm going to be realistic medically with this. She's going to pop his eyeball out.
And that's really cool because Linda is a doctor as well. So it should be medically adequate, the splatter. Though.
Trying to fit it back in.
Oh, yeah. It's structurally, it's a really, really good novel because it makes sense to read it twice because for the second time, I see how well prepared everything is. And now I have an author's question. So you plan it through or you go just back and make sure it all turns out fine?
No planning at all. I kind of just write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until I think, okay, I like this story. Usually I start with the story that I think that I love. And by like 3 months in or 6 months in, I think, and I have a better way to tell this. And I'll change everything up, but keep something that really matters to me. For me, the biggest thing was the revelations within the family with A Better World. That was what I wanted. So it was those moments where they realize who they are. Where Hip says, Dad thinks or Mom thinks men are weak.
Mm.
And these are our family dynamics. And you never saw them. And I thought that was what I was shooting for. And then the rest of it, you just go back. For me, I go back and I sort of comb everything through and make sure it all adds up.
Yes. And I really like the relationship between Linda and her daughter, Josie, who really has a hard time and wants to leave. And it's so obvious that Josie wants to leave. She cries like, I'm not happy here. Why are we here? Linda tries to talk to her and says all kinds of stuff, but not, let's leave here. And that's the only thing Josie wants to hear. But Linda is not there yet. She has to go there in her own pace. She goes there eventually. And then Josie is all in and helps her. And it's a really cool mother-daughter relationship and mother-daughter action in the end. And I really like that. And Josie is like my favorite character, even as she doesn't have so much stage time as other characters. But she's really, I really feel for her. And she seems to be like, almost perfect. A little bit complex, of course. She's really depressed most of the novel, but it's understandable. And well, and Linda just tries to do the right things, and she does some really, really brave things, which I really adore, like saving other people's children, which is really, really cool, I think, and risking so much. Well, it's cool. There's a lot of tension and suspense in the novel. I was glad when I already knew how it would all turn out and just can read it again in peace. Or relative peace, you know, eye-popping. Yeah, well.
Yeah, I mean, I like that family dynamic. And I like that idea of, here's the thing, like, I think in Good Neighbors, there's critical moments throughout the story where if it's tragic because characters didn't react the way they could have acted. And I think in a Better World is a different look at critical moments. And the different look is maybe there are no critical moments. Maybe there's Linda who just never stops trying. She's like, and she's not. There are so many times in parenting where I'm just not giving them what they want emotionally because I'm not, you know, I'm trying to, but I'm not seeing the world they're seeing the way they see it. And then, you know, like one day you do it and you realize what it is they want and you're able to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that happens is because you just don't stop. You check in, you know, yeah, they're rolling their eyes at you and they don't want to talk to you and your idea is stupid. And probably it's because it is. It's not out of nowhere that they have an issue with you, with my parenting. But one day, because you don't stop trying, you figure it out and you have this connection. And I think that's a lot of what human relationships are. And I think it's just, we're at this moment in pop psychology where Lock and Key is the reason that things are happening. Like, oh, it's because of this. Oh, it's because of this one thing. I turned the lock with this key. But I think the truth is, it's just showing up every day and being existing and trying that is so much more important than these answers.
Yeah, I agree. And there's this nice moment when Hip and Josie agree that they think their parents are weird, but they don't hate them as much as other people's parents.
Yeah. I don't know if you had this, but that moment where I thought, when you were a kid, you'd think, oh, my parents, they're just the worst. But I would not want to live in a different family.
Yes. Because other people's houses smell differently.
Oh, they smell. Yes. That odd, different smell of other people's houses.
Yes, and I think it's important to go through that as well as a child, to learn that there are other smells in the world. I'm afraid we run out of time. So if there's something you want to share with a mostly German audience, this is the right time for it.
I'm just really excited, and I want to thank you, Yvonne, for enjoying the books and, you know, for this excellent interview. How did you come across the books?
Locus Interview.
Right, right.
Yeah, in August. And I read the Locus every month and usually the reviews, but mostly I read the interviews as well. When I realize it's mostly about fantasy, I try not to read the interviews because I try to avoid fantasy, which doesn't always work, just because of time and focus on science fiction and horror. And your interview was just so interesting because of all the subtle sexism you outcalled. And I thought that might be interesting for me to read. And it was.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad you did. And, you know, hello to everyone listening. And this has been really awesome.
Yeah, thank you. It was very fun to talk to you about these books. And if the new book, Frenemy, will come out, maybe we'll meet again. And I learned that there will be a novella and several short stories next year. So I will follow it.
Yay! I'm glad.
Okay. We will put all the links to the books and your website in the show notes so everybody can decide what to buy and what to listen to. Ciao.